insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hello and good morning and welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show, where you never know what kind of a conversation you might hear. And as I like to say, it could be your conversation if you call me at this number, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Email patrick@relevantradio.com. I would be more than happy to receive your email. And I have quite a few here that I'd like to get to as well. One of which came in yesterday. Cyrus, you'll like this. We were jokingly referring to Wham! And that other guy in Wham! Well, Don, he made sure to write to me and tell me what his name was and information about him, I think in a tongue-in-cheek sort of way. But my thanks to you, Don. I mean, our listeners don't miss a lick.
Did you learn more about Wham! Than you ever wanted to know?
I suppose I might have, yeah. I mean, I had forgotten his name, but it's Andrew Ridley. Ridley or Ridgely, I forget which. And he tried to do a solo album.
I now know more about Wham! Than I ever knew.
Yeah. See how you learn a lot of things here on the Patrick Madrid Show? So anyway, Don, thank you for that. That's kind of you to update me on that. I have a note here. This is from Carl listening on the Relevant Radio app. It has to do with suffering. And he says, I have a coworker who's not a practicing Catholic, and his daughter was received into the church on the Easter Vigil this past Saturday. He attended the Mass and stated that he does not need to attend Mass since he has a one-on-one relationship, I guess, with God. Carl says, I tried to share with him why it is important to attend Mass, and so he could be in full communion with the church. If he went to confession and confessed his sins, he would be forgiven. My question is, he then said, why does God allow children to die? I, with my limited theological knowledge, said that it's due to our free will and that we are all born with original sin due to Adam and Eve. I hope you can share some other insights. I feel that my coworker may return to the Catholic Church, and I hope I can be helpful to him in his return. And he says, I enjoy listening to your show, and I thank you and Cyrus for helping me learn more about my faith, and I hope you make it to New Orleans soon. Well, that's kind of you, Carl. Okay, let's start with his question about why does God allow children to die? This is just one version of what's known as the problem of evil. And the problem of evil goes something like this. If God is all-loving, as you Catholics claim, and he's all-powerful, as you Catholics claim, then why does evil exist? Or to put it differently, how can evil exist if God is all-loving and all-powerful? Either evil is there because God isn't all-loving, and he doesn't really love you because he allows evil to exist, or God is not all-powerful because he can't stop it. Therefore, some people conclude God doesn't exist at all because of the presence of evil. And the question that the gentleman asked you is a rendition of that problem of evil. So we'll talk a little bit about that, and I'll give you some resources where you can go for more information and a much deeper explanation. I'll try to give you a cursory explanation here. Let's also point out, and maybe in your conversation with him, you could point out that evil, even though he didn't use the word evil, he asked the question, why does God allow children to die? But I think he would agree that it's an evil thing when an innocent child dies. And evil as such is not a thing. It's not, as the philosophers would say, a substance. And I don't mean substance as in like a sticky substance on the kitchen counter. What I mean is, it's the philosophical term for the thing itself, the reality of the thing itself. So the substance of evil, in the way we might talk about a human person, an angelic person, a paper cup, a house, a city, we can look at different things and say that is real, and we can know things about it. But evil is real, but it's not a thing. And this is an important preliminary to help us understand the way that evil works. So it's not a thing. Even the devil himself, Satan himself, as evil as he is not pure evil. he sort of personifies evil at the lowest level. But even he has some goodness to him. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not in any way showing sympathy for the devil at all. He is a hell-bound, a hell eternally bound creature who will never come back from his separation from God. So he, all he does is evil. All he thinks is evil. All he plots is evil. He is, you might say, the personification of evil. But he's not pure evil. Even he, as crazy as this might sound, has some goodness, and you can demonstrate that by the fact that he exists, which, of course, is something the devil doesn't want you to think anyway. He doesn't want you to think that he exists. He's really pleased, you can imagine, when people say, oh, the devil doesn't really exist. That's just a, you know, it's just a character in a moral tale in the Bible, and it's not real. It's not a real angelic person. Yeah, he is. He's real. And his reality means that he exists, and his existence means that he has being. This is where metaphysics gets involved. Being, the quality of existing, is something that comes from God. God is existence itself. So even the evil one, as bad as he is, he has some goodness in him that probably infuriates him, and that is that the fact that he exists means that he's participating in one of the highest, most important aspects of God's nature, which is existence itself. He receives his existence from God. The reason I'm going into this little bit of detail here is to be able to say that we don't experience pure evil. We experience manifestations of an evil. A child dies. A tsunami wipes out a bunch of people. There were two big earthquakes in Taiwan, you may have heard yesterday. And I don't know how many people were injured or killed, but that would be an example of a natural evil. So you have moral evil, where people make decisions that cause harm and pain and misery to others. You also have natural evils, which are the result of natural phenomena, like earthquakes, for example. So when we consider these types of evil, and that evil is not in itself a thing, it's seen in other things. And the philosophers would also point out, and rightly so, that evil is the absence of a due good. Now, due, spelled D-U-E, it's the absence of a due good, meaning that there's something good that should be there, but it isn't there, and that's what creates or manifests this evil. And let's take the case that he brought up. Why does God allow children to die? Well, the due good, D-U-E, is that the child should be alive. The child should live. Life is natural to human beings, life and health, etc. So when that good is absent in the case of the child, when life is no longer present, you have the absence of a good that should be there, and it's not. And that's why we instinctively recognize that innocent children dying is a kind of evil. And the method of their death, I hate to even think about it, can complicate that, can be death from a disease, death from an injury, death by murder, God forbid. So there are gradations of intensity and depravity of evil. Why does God allow this? God has unfolding constantly for all of us in this life something that we call providence. It's his plan for our ultimate happiness. And sometimes our ultimate happiness cannot be achieved without suffering along the way. And we all know that in mundane ways, and this is by no means a comparison with the horror and death of a child, but just to give some basic building block examples. If you want to win a championship football game and you're the football team, you have to go through a lot of pain and a lot of exhaustion and repetition, and you'd rather be eating different food and maybe not having to get up so early or go to the weight room every day and all the suffering that's involved in preparing to be a good football player and a good football team. But you do go through those things willingly, in fact, in order to achieve the higher good of winning championship football games. So that's a mundane example. There are many other examples. If you want to become proficient at the piano, there's a lot of trial and error, a lot of, you, not, I wouldn't call it suffering per se, unless you're the person who has to listen to the person who's learning the piano. There's some suffering there perhaps. But there's a lot of fatigue and repetition, and I really don't feel like practicing the piano today. But if you want to become a concert pianist, you need to put in the hours of drudgery and practice and repetition, etc. So those are a couple examples. So when it comes to these kinds of high-level evils, why doesn't God intervene? Why doesn't he stop it? Why doesn't every time some child gets sick, why doesn't God work a miracle? Now, sometimes he does. I'd say rarely these things happen, but they do happen. And this can be understood as part of the power of prayer, that we can help change things. Not that we're changing God's mind, but in from all eternity, his plan included that there would be a change, and the change is affected through our prayers. That's a separate issue, but it's related. So why doesn't God do that? Well, I think the answer is, you alluded to it, and that is that because God created us out of love and for love, the only way that you and I can respond to God's love is if we are free, if we have a free will. If you're not truly free, yes, you have a bent, a fallen human nature, and your will is not perfectly intact, and it's encumbered by your lower appetites and passions and things like that. So we all have to deal with those issues. But we still are free. You can still make a free will choice. And if you couldn't, you couldn't be guilty of doing anything wrong because you had no choice in the matter. You didn't choose to do something wrong. And if you're not guilty of that, then you couldn't be punished for that. And yet we know that God is all just. And his justice is founded in, at least in terms of its relation to human beings, it's based upon, or you might say it acts upon the results of our human free will choices. So the essence of the problem of evil lies in this direction, that because God loves you and he wants you to be happy, he created you free, and your freedom involves the risk that you might say no, you might commit a sin. And if you couldn't commit a sin, you obviously couldn't love God. You would be just sort of an algorithm in the program, and you would do what you were programmed to do. But that's not how we are. So we have the ability to reject God. We have the ability to accept God. So when, through our sins, we create this ripple effect into the lives of other people that could result in injury. I'm thinking about a drunk driver who's speeding along, crashes into a young mom's minivan, she's bringing her three kids home from school, and all of them get killed. We hear stories like that on a all too regular basis. Innocent people who die because of the bad, the evil free will choice of another person. So why does God permit this to happen? I think the best way, in a shorter answer that I could give you, would be because God creates us to be free, he permits things that he doesn't will to happen. He doesn't will the death of the mother and her three children in the minivan, but he permits these things, as painful and as incomprehensible as they are, because, among other reasons, we're told in the Bible that all things work together for the good for those who love God. So there, his plan of providence, as it continually unfolds, includes good, if you can imagine it, that will come out of things that are the result of evil. Moral evils or natural evils. It's mysterious. It's mysterious, and we have a difficult time trying to imagine how can any good come from this? And that's where we have to trust in God. But in the meantime, what we can say is God, respecting our human freedom, permits us to make our decisions, and our decisions usually, I mean, if it's a sinful decision, it usually, if not always, causes harm, sadness, or worse, to other people. It's that ripple effect. So this is the problem of evil, and it actually points to the existence of God, as opposed to suggesting that God doesn't exist. It means that in order for us to recognize something as evil or good, but in this case we're talking about evil, why does God permit someone to die? There's something wrong with that, and we all instinctively know that. That points to the fact that there must be some transcendent reality that is above our own subjective preferences. I would prefer that children not die. Okay, that's good for me. That's how I feel about it, but it's subjective. But when we all recognize and can say without anyone having to tell us, that's wrong, there's something evil there, that this should take place, we're recognizing an objective reality that is not dependent upon your or my personal preferences. And that begins to open the door to realize there's something more than just nature, just the natural level. There's something above that. And we can appeal to that. This is good. In itself, it's good. Honesty is good. Generosity is good. Sacrificing for other people is good. It may involve pain. It may involve difficulty. But we instinctively recognize that those things are good in themselves, independent of what other people might think or what people may do in any given situation. We also recognize that certain things are evil, regardless of what people think or do. Many people do evil things, but stealing we all know is wrong. Murder we know is wrong. And the many other things that are hardwired into our very being as humans, we recognize that certain things are wrong. Well, that's recognizing this objective reality that transcends nature. And when you start looking at those issues and you look at them in that way, it opens the door for seeing more clearly that there must be something above nature. We call that something or someone God, which brings us back to the question. And I'll leave it at this. I'd like to give you a couple of resources. I just gave you a kind of a sketch overview of the bigger picture of the problem of evil. God permits these things to happen, and for ways and for reasons that we don't fully understand. Sometimes we catch a glimpse of it here or there. But if you want to go deeper, I would recommend two books. One by Dr. Peter Kraft. It's called Making Sense Out of Suffering. It's a book-length discussion of this issue, and he goes into, obviously, much greater depth, Making Sense Out of Suffering. The second book was co-authored by Dr. Peter Kraft and Father Ron Tosselli, both of whom are philosophers at Boston College for many years. This book is called Handbook of Catholic Apologetics. And you want to zero in on the section on the problem of evil, which runs for probably about 30 pages. And even though it's a more condensed version of what Peter Kraft says in his book, Making Sense Out of Suffering, it's in certain ways more systematic. And it goes through all the various objections to what I'm explaining here. I haven't anticipated the objections or responded to the objections, but there are some objections. And in that book, Handbook of Catholic Apologetics, they delve into that in a systematic way. Now, I'll leave you with one final thought. In your conversation with this gentleman that you're talking about here, and you're trying to share with him why he should go to Mass, I can understand that if he has been scarred or traumatized by some evils in his life, maybe of his own doing, or maybe things that have happened to him, perhaps the death of a child or something like that. Those are heavy duty hits that can really interrupt someone's way of thinking about God, or it can distort people's perception of God. That's a common thing. So my suggestion would be, show him through your own kindness and compassion, your own reflection of the love of God. And don't push him, don't prod him, but do what you've done and continue to do that. Continue inviting him to Mass. Continue being a presence in his life, showing him the kindness of God. Maybe if you find these two books that I recommended to you, maybe you can give him a copy of that. Maybe Making Sense Out of Suffering would be a good place to start. Maybe get him a copy of that book and say, you know, I've been reading this book and thinking about it, and I really think that what he's saying here might be of interest to you. So check it out. And I do appreciate that thoughtful email. And by all means, Carl, I would very much love to know how this turns out a month from now, 6 months from now, a year from now, what have you. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. This hour is supported by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union. Join the nation's largest Catholic-oriented credit union and receive $200 when you add a direct deposit. Learn more at NotreDameFCU.com/join. That's NotreDameFCU.com/join.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
I remember this song. I think from the 90s or something. What's this one called?
What could it possibly be?
What could
called?
It possibly be? Oh, it has to do with sweat. That's right.
Oh, it's not called Everybody Dance Now?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, maybe it is.
I thought it's called Everybody Dance Now.
What do I know?
I don't know.
It could be called that.
This is out of the Wham catalog, as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, please. It's not that bad. All right. You're still thinking about Wham. It made a big impression upon you yesterday, didn't it?
I'm getting all the records. I'm doing a deep dive.
Oh, man. Well, when you recover from all of that, let me know. Let's go to David in the Twin Cities. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Patrick. My six-year-old has been asking some good questions about God, and I'm said, let's just call Patrick Madrid for this one. He's talking about, he's just saying, you know, where do we come from, or you know, where does this come from, and explaining that things come from God, and you know, then he was pointing at a toy. He's like, is God in this thing? And I was getting a little confused because it's like God subsists in everything, in my opinion, and this is where you can correct me if I'm wrong, but like where I feel like God subsists in everything, but then God like isn't in that toy. Or again, this is where I'm just calling for mm-hmm. some assistance.
I think I can give you a couple things that will help.
Okay.
Was there more to it, though? I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, without it, so maybe if you could explain maybe to a child, and then maybe if you could go just one level deeper with me, that it's not panentheism, because I didn't even know what that was before calling you, but in my mind, my thought of what God is more like panentheism versus mm-hmm. theism, where the universe subsides in God. So I'll just let you.
Sure. So panentheism is for those who don't know, it's the beliefs or the notion that God is in everything. And the church does not accept panentheism or pantheism for that matter. But there is a little hint of truth in panentheism that we can discuss. So what you're really saying is explain it to me like I'm 6 years old. So that's what I'll try to do. I'll do my best. So I would say, first of all, that God is in things in different ways, and they're not all the same way. So God is in the world, meaning that he, being the creator of everything, either directly or indirectly, his presence is felt through his creative will. He wills things into existence. And so he's present in that sense, in a way similar, you could explain to your son, you know, if you and your wife were to go out for a date night and he's at home, maybe with an older brother or sister who's in charge, and he's told, you know, at 8 o'clock, you have to go to bed. Well, you're not present at home because you're out at the date night, but your presence is still felt by your authority. Your authority as mom and dad is still there in a way, but you're not physically there. He might understand that, you know. That's right. Well, my mom and dad, they told me I have to go to bed at 8 o'clock. And even though they're not here, they're still kind of here in a way that their rule is present to me. That's one way. God can be present specifically in a place. We know that's true in the case of Jesus. And you could say, here's a different way that God is present. And when God, you know, being the second person of the Trinity, who in the incarnation became one of us in Jesus, he was literally present in that body that the apostles could see, the body of Jesus. They could see Jesus, they couldn't see his divinity, but God was present there in a unique way, in a way that he wasn't present in that way in any of the apostles or in the Blessed Virgin Mary or any person or anything else. He was present in Jesus in another very specific way. He's present in other ways as well. So in the Holy Eucharist, God is present there, and he's present in all the consecrated hosts all around the whole world, in all the masses, everywhere, at all times. Jesus, is as God, is present there in another way. It's a different way of being present. So when he holds up this toy and says, is God in this, you would say no. God is everywhere, and God, in a sense, is in everything, but not in the way that you're thinking. It's not like if you broke the toy open, could you find God in there? No. He's not present in that toy in the way your soul is present in your body. He's present in a different way, meaning that his, as I said earlier, he created all of these things directly or indirectly. He sustains them. He holds them in existence. All of these realities that we take for granted wouldn't even be here if God didn't, from moment to moment, will them to exist. So I would leave, personally, I would leave it, my explanation for a six-year-old along those lines. I wouldn't want to overpower him with other concepts, but I think, and I'd like to know what you think, David, because you're his father, I would think that the little six-year-old guy could at least understand those concepts. Do you think he would?
Yes. And I think that you touched on a couple of things that have already been brought up in terms of other ways that God has been particularly unique. You know, mm-hmm. namely in like the Eucharist and as a person, you know, and so that will be super helpful as we re-listen to this tonight, and he's going to be pretty giddy with that response. And
let's hear his name on national radio, on international radio. What is his name? That'll give him an even bigger thrill.
Hello, Declan.
Declan. So, Declan. Awesome. Yep. Hello, Declan.
My little Irishman.
I have a grandson named Declan. That's a cool name. Okay, yeah, good. Thanks. So we discussed that a little bit. Now, if you're interested in more on panentheism, that book I recommended a few minutes ago, by coincidence, it's called Handbook of Catholic Apologetics. They have a section in there where they discuss the distinction between panentheism, pantheism, and, of course, what we believe as Christian theists, that God is not present in all of creation the way the panentheists think, but there is that little kernel of truth that he does have a presence in the universe in a different way. So you might check that book out.
And can you repeat that name? I didn't catch that.
Sure. Of the Handbook book? Of Catholic Apologetics.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. All right. You'll like it.
Okay. Thank you so much, Patrick. Appreciate
it. You're welcome. You're welcome. Nice chatting. Thank you. Let's go to Mike in Minnesota now. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning,
hello,
Patrick.
Mike. Hi.
Yeah, I have a question on indulgences.
Okay.
First off, how can we be totally detached from all sin, including venial sin? I imagine myself going to confession mm-hmm. and concentrating after the fact on being detached from venial sin, which is going to cause me to think, well, I got to make sure I don't think about that. And if I start saying I don't think about that, I am in fact thinking about that, and I would think that I might be not mm-hmm. detached from venial sin, if that is so easy.
Well, I can explain it to you. So it's an act of the will. It's not an emotion. It's not, you know, your thought process per se, but it's an act of the will in which you say to the Lord and to yourself, in your own words, Lord, here and now, I choose with my weakness and in my weakness, I'm choosing to have no love for any sin at all. I don't want to ever commit a sin, Lord, and I intend to live a virtuous life. And all of my past sins, I renounce them, and I will, you know, I don't want to even have any pleasure in any memory of any sin that I've ever committed. So it's an act of the will. Now, in your emotions, you might feel differently, and certainly in your intellect, you realize that you're weak, as we all are, and that we all fall into sin. By the time one matures in the Christian life, falling back into mortal sin typically never happens anymore. So when somebody gets to the point where they never, ever, ever, ever fall into mortal sin, that's a sign of their Christian maturity. But even if somebody's not at that point yet, even if you recognize in your weakness that you could fall back into sin, to be detached from sin for this purpose here is an act of the will in which you say, I do not want to sin, and I do not want to have any pleasant memories or anything. I have no attachment in any way to any of my prior sins. And that's all that's necessary. So it's an act of the will.
I see. I mean, personally, I'm not too concerned about mortal sin at this time in my life, but however, I need to be detached from venial sin. I think that's a pretty tall thing to jump over.
I don't think it is, though. I really don't. In other words, I mean, why would God give, think of it this way. Why would the Lord ask of you something that is nigh unto impossible? You know, and the passage from the Bible, I forget which one it is, but, you know, you say, this is too difficult, God says. You know, you don't have to go up into the clouds and get this. You don't have to go across the ocean to get this. You don't have to do something really difficult to get this. This is right here in front of you. I'm paraphrasing, of course. So my thought, Mike, is if you think of this in terms of I'm making a decision for God and I'm turning my back on sin, and yeah, I know I'm weak and I'm going to fall into sin at some point or in some way. That's not what's part of this. What's part of this is that decision to cut ties with sin. And that's not a tall order. I mean, not everybody is willing to do that, but it's not difficult to do if you focus your mind on that and say, no, I really am choosing God and I'm turning my back on sin. I want to have no attachment to sin, Lord, and I need your help. That's sufficient in itself.
I looked at a Catholic website. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was a couple years old. And it said something like an indulgence cannot be received if a reason for participating in the Divine Mercy Sunday, or et cetera, is to avoid hell or purgatory. It must be purely from love of God. You comment?
Yeah, well, that gets to the heart of how the church defines what we call true contrition. So true contrition is sorrow for sin and a firm purpose of amendment out of love for God more than a fear of punishment. I mean, we all fear punishment, and at some level, even the greatest of saints, although they love God very much, they also fear punishment. And so it doesn't mean that there can't be some inkling of you don't want to go to hell, but the primary motive would be that you love God. Because if it's just fear of hell, that would be what's known as attrition. There are different terms that are used, but attrition would be one example where it's not salvific. If you're sorry just because you don't want to get punished, that kind of sorrow for sin is not enough. It has to be based on charity, the supernatural gift of charity. And your love for God, even if it's weak and flickering and sputtering, that's what they're getting at there. Now, this sounds like it's somebody's explanation of it. I don't recall ever reading those specific words in Pope John Paul II's promulgation of the Divine Mercy Sunday indulgence, but I'd have to go back and reread that. But theologically speaking, that's correct. But even that, too, is not an emotion. It's an act of the will. So when you say the act of contrition, you know, the part, you know, I'm heartily sorry for having offended thee because of thy just punishment, but most of all, because I have offended thee, my God, who are all good and deserving of all my love. So in that act of contrition, we acknowledge our fear of punishment, but we say, but more than that, Lord, it's because I love you and I know that I shouldn't offend you. What do you think?
Thank you. That's it's more peaceful. It lends more peaceful explanation.
I'm glad. Let me recommend a book. I have a feeling if you're feeling unsettled in some way, Mike, and I'm not asking any private questions or anything, but there's a really good book. I found it very helpful. It's called Interior Freedom by Father Jacques Philippe. So stick an E at the end of Philip. Father Jacques Philippe. It's not a very big book, Interior Freedom. And I think it will, to whatever extent you feel uneasy about such issues, that book I think will really help you overcome that. To whatever extent you may feel uneasy, I think that book will help you. Okay?
Thank you.
Interior Freedom. I think you'll love it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good chatting with you. And this is the perfect time to take a break. We'll do that, and we'll come back with more of your phone calls and emails. They keep rolling in, and I appreciate that. Thank you. To email me, just send it to me at patrick@relevantradio.com. The phone number is 888-914-9149. That number is sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. This hour is sponsored by Christendom College's free Principles classes. Sign up for a free online class on Holy Scripture today at newtestamentfoundations.com. Learn to read the Bible with the mind of the church at newtestamentfoundations.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Mm. Yeah, I like this.
You like it?
I do.
All right.
It projects power.
It sure does.
And you know why? Because it's got a good bass line.
That's why I thought you would like it, is that bass line.
It projects power. I like that. Kind of like this show, I hope. 888-914-9149. Holy Ghost power, of course. That's what I'm talking about, Cyrus. 888-914-9149. Let's go to John in Lisle, Illinois. Good morning, John. Oh, what? John just dropped. John, come on now. All right, call back, John. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Charlie in Philadelphia. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Don LeDay. I had a thought that you were talking about sin and mortal sin and being free of mortal sin. Mm-hmm. I read The Map of Life by Frank Sheed years ago. I read it several times. It's a wonderful catechism, I think.
Yeah.
But he pointed out to something that I didn't know until I read it from him. As your sin decreases and you become holier, you get imbued with supernatural grace, which everybody has grace or they wouldn't be alive. But supernatural mm-hmm. grace from God opens you up to, like, I guess, your intuition and things like that to get, like, you know, the will of God in you. And you become, of course, less selfish, means, you know, that all sin comes from selfishness. Mm-hmm. But it opens you up and it makes your prayers more powerful. And that got me to thinking that St. James writes in his epistle that the prayers of a righteous man are very powerful. And he mentions Elijah, I think it is, that he had the power to shut up the heavens from the rain and open it up again.
Yeah.
And that started me thinking, like, imagine what it was like when you had 50,000 or 30,000 just Benedictine monasteries in Europe, with all these men in there that were either holy or becoming holy, all praying, you know what I mean, for the good of mm-hmm. mankind, for this, that, and the other.
I mean,
how much power that must have had. You know what I'm saying? That we need that again. We need these monasteries in this country. You know,
Jesus talked about that, as I'm sure you remember, Charlie. He said, if you had faith as small as a mustard seed, you could say to this tree, pick yourself up and throw yourself into the ocean, or that mountain over there, things like that. And there's a figurative quality to what he's saying there, but it ties in with what you're saying. And that is, if you were truly imbued with the grace of God, there are many things that you can't do now that you could do in that situation. And I think that's evidenced by the great saints, who accomplished unbelievable things.
I think it's a wasted resource that we have millions of, especially men, but men and women retired, Catholics, a lot of them are just Catholic and birth only, but mm-hmm. if they were all praying every day and going to church and just thinking of power they could have to turn things around, like in this country and the way it's going and et cetera, you know what I mean? And help out other countries. And there's just so much power being lost there. I'm talking about supernatural power.
No, I get it. I totally get it. So I'm not sure if you had a question attached to that thought. If not, that's fine.
Am I on the right track? You're saying what I'm saying. Yeah, that was my question.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Charlie. Totally.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Have a good day.
Okay, that sounds good to me. I appreciate it. Yeah, Jesus said so. If you had the faith the size of a mustard seed, and that's pretty small, you could do things that you can't normally do. There's another dimension to what Charlie's talking about. I'll just touch on that for a minute. It has to do with a lightness and heaviness. St. Thomas talks about this in the Summa Theologiae, that is. And that is that just as bodies that are heavier are more cumbersome and less agile, in the same way the soul, regardless of the condition of the body, but the soul that is lighter because it is freer from sin. Sin drags us down. And so he uses this analogy of bodily weight and agility with the growth and holiness in your soul. And if your soul is imbued more and more with God's grace, he describes it as a kind of lightness that you naturally are going to go up. You will ascend more easily to God. And if you are weighted down by your slavery to appetites and passions and what have you, it in a similar kind of way, it drags you down. And that's an easy way to think about it, because we all know what that's like, you know, in our own bodily conditions. So the point Charlie was making is that the more you are imbued with the grace of God, the more power you have, not to exert over things or to dominate things or people, but you can accomplish more. If you are light and agile and lithe and fit and trim and all the terms that we use for this, you can run a long distance. You can do many things physically that if you are weighed down by bodily weight, that the things you can't do, or you, at least you can't do easily, or you can't do without a great deal of effort, those things you can do when you're physically fit and you weigh a lot less. So it's another way to think about the kind of power that comes with being plugged into the Lord. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Zachary in Wyckoff, New Jersey. Good morning, Zachary.
Good morning. I just wanted to call into the radio station today while I'm on my way to work and just thank you for everything you guys have done over on this radio station. I had found your bumper sticker on the way to work one day and decided to tune in through my radio. And it's honestly, you guys have just helped with a lot of day-to-day stresses.
Oh, that makes me very happy, Zachary. Thank you for that. Are you Catholic or non-Catholic?
I'm Catholic.
Well, that's great. I mean, we have a lot of non-Catholic people listening. That's why I wondered. But if you don't mind my asking, anything specific that you've gained from listening to Relevant Radio, any particular way it's helped you, or is it just sort of a general well-being that you're experiencing?
It's definitely general well-being, but one thing that really helped me was, I believe it was last month or perhaps the month before, there had been a woman that came on to talk about some of her stresses and her injured relationship with her brother.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think about my kind of torn relationship with my older sister. And I had reached out to her recently, and we're set up for a little brunch to catch up on everything.
Oh, that's great.
So in a way, listening in helped me with my family as well.
I'm so happy to hear that. I really am. And who knows, maybe after you have your brunch and your relationship is strengthened with her, maybe she'll start listening. We can have a chain reaction effect here. And if she's listening...
I definitely hope so.
Yeah, because who knows what other, you know, loose ends she might have in her life, and maybe this will help her sort those things out. And, you know, one person at a time. You know, the way I like to think of it, Zachary, is if you like it, share it. So if you like Relevant Radio, the more you share it, the more people benefit.
I definitely will. And once again, thank you all down there for everything you've been doing. Like I said, this has genuinely helped me with peace of mind in these past coming months.
I'm very happy to hear that, Zachary. Well, thank you, and I hope that that continues and grows and gets even better than it is now. Thank you so much for that. Isn't that great, Cyrus? Bumper stickers.
Bumper
it's amazing
stickers.
The power of bumper stickers.
Get a bumper sticker. They're awesome.
Yeah.
And then when you're driving around...
Where am I supposed to get it?
I should have had that ready. And when you're driving around and you see someone with, a car driving by, and they've got a Relevant Radio bumper sticker just like yours. It's like, yeah, they get it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's always neat to see those in traffic, especially where we have stations. I think we have about 220 stations around the country now with our beloved affiliates included. Shout out to all of our affiliates, by the way. If you want a bumper sticker, wherever you may be.
Where am I supposed to get it?
That guy. He does a better version than I do. If you want a bumper sticker or even two, just go to relevantradio.com, and in the navigation bar, you'll see listen, support, faith, contact. Mouse over the word support, and there's a drop-down menu at the very bottom. It's request a bumper sticker. So when you tell us where you want us to send it, we'll be able to determine which of our stations is closest to you. And then we'll send you one or two of these bumper stickers. So like 9:30 a.m., 100.7 FM, 10:10 a.m., 8:40 a.m., etc. We also have a bumper sticker for you, even if you don't live in an area where we have a station yet. And we are growing and growing. So in due time, hopefully, we will have a station where you are. You can get the one that just says Relevant Radio. Listen at relevantradio.com. So you can be anywhere. You could be in the Philippines. You could be in Zimbabwe. You could be in wherever and put that Relevant Radio bumper sticker and people will see it.
Excellent.
And it is true. We do hear on a regular basis similar comments like the one that we just heard a moment ago of people who had no clue that Relevant Radio existed, and maybe they were even far from God, and they happened to see the bumper sticker, and curiosity got the better of them. They started listening, and good things happened. That's great. Let's go to Jacinto now in Del Rio, Texas. Hello, Jacinto. Hello, Jacinto.
Hi there.
Hello there.
Hello.
Ah, hello.
Hello, hello. What?
Huh?
Can you hear me? I'm sorry.
Ah, hi, Jacinto.
Yes.
You're on the air now. You have to turn your radio down, though, or you'll get confused.
You got it. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Good morning. One of my questions was, I run into a lot of people. I'm a practicing Catholic, but I love the church. And like especially family members, or, you know, I have my brother and his girlfriend. And she's a Christian, you know, not Catholic, but she's always like, well, as long as you believe in God and in Jesus, that's all that matters. It doesn't matter what mm-hmm. church to go to. What I'm curious, how can I come about it to try to convince them it's not just about that? You know, any like specific scriptures or something that I can just, mm-hmm. you know, sit down with them and just try to convince? Because my little brother, well, he's not that little. He's 40, but he's not baptized. And I would love for him to get baptized and come mm-hmm. into the church. And he finally met this young lady, which she was Catholic, but she left the Catholic church okay. because the priest wasn't, I guess, moving her enough, or the homilies, I guess, they don't have a guitar and a drum set on stage and stuff, you know, mm-hmm. to get them riled up. But
so the local mega church or whatever, they have the band and they've got the electrifying preaching. Yeah, yep. I'm familiar with that. Mm-hmm. So here's some things. You're looking for some specific verses. You might try these. Jesus says in Matthew 7, so we're going to look at Matthew 7, 21 and 22. He says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. And let's pause there for a second. What is the will of the Father? Well, when we see two specific times, once when Jesus was baptized in the River Jordan, and once when Jesus is on the summit of Mount Tabor, and he's transfigured before Peter, James, and John, and he's seen with Moses and Elijah, just to give you a sense of context. And the Father speaks from heaven. They hear the voice of God the Father in heaven, who says, this is my beloved Son, listen to him. And this is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased, in the case of the baptism. So when God the Father says, this is my beloved Son, listen to him, it's the answer to the question that Jesus is sort of alluding to in Matthew 7, 21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Well, the question is, what is the will of the Father who is in heaven? He's told us, listen to my Son, listen to Jesus. Verse 22, on that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? Did we not cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name? And what does Jesus say in response to them? He says, I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you evildoers. And then in the next verse, verse 24, he says, everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them, action involved, will be like a wise man who built his house upon the rock. And you know this verse, and the rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat upon that house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. And Jesus says, everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house upon the sand. And the rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. So this extended passage here tells so much, including that there are people who in this life, they think they've got it made in the shade. They think, yeah, I'm casting out demons and I'm doing mighty works in the name of Jesus and I'm prophesying in the name of Jesus. And maybe what your brother's wife or the lady that you just mentioned is saying, you know, and I'm a good person and I love Jesus, but I don't really do what he said to do. which is, for example, be baptized, receive his body and blood in the form of the Holy Eucharist, John chapter 6, he who eats my flesh and drinks my blood has life within him. He who doesn't eat my flesh and doesn't drink my blood will have no life within him. And he gives us his flesh and blood in the form of bread and wine, under the appearance of bread and wine, at Mass. Every Mass, we participate in that once-for-all sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. He wants to feed you and strengthen you and guide you through the teaching of his church. In Matthew 28, he tells the apostles, go into the whole world, make disciples of all nations, baptizing them. And a disciple is one who follows. You follow the master. You don't just stay put where you are. You don't say, well, I'm going to do it my way. I think my way is pretty good. There's a band where I like to go. And that stuff that Jesus said, that's not really important. It doesn't really apply to me. Well, that's whom Jesus will be talking to when he says, on that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, and I will say, away from me, I never knew you.